Hello, and welcome to this EG Politics podcast. I'm your host, Deputy Editor Tim Burke. Since last week's landslide win for the Conservative Party in the general election, we've seen house builders' shares rise, newfound confidence in London's prime residential market, commercial agents gleefully anticipating the return of big deals to the market. It appears, at first glance at least, to be a good result for property. An industry figure speaking with EG in recent days have given the new government a cautious thumbs up and welcomed what they hope to be some long-needed political certainty. To discuss the result in more depth, I'm joined again by former Conservative MP and former Housing Minister, Mark Prisk. Mark, thanks for being here with EG.
Thank you, Tim.
As the dust settles, what are your reflections on the election campaign and the result of last week?
I think there's a lot to take in, but for me, I think the first thing is that whatever your views about Brexit, Remain or Leave, I almost could sense an outward sigh of relief from most uncommitted souls, in the sense that we've now moved from an era where there was indecision after indecision because there's no majority in the Commons, to now realising that actually the government of the day has a working majority and can do its job and get on, not only with Brexit, but all the other things. So my sense of the public mood is, let's just draw a line on this, let's have a working government, and let's get on with the business of government so we in the public can do the get back to our lives, because I just got the impression that people felt it wasn't just get Brexit done, it was get on with your job, politicians, and therefore the squabbling and the rows and so on were I think something that people felt was just so debilitating. You couldn't confidently take on a new mortgage, you weren't sure to take on new staff, you weren't really sure what was going to happen, you know, within a week, let alone a year. So I think a line has been drawn. I think there's a couple of other things, though, as well, looking back at it now, with a few days. And that is, first of all, whilst clearly Jeremy Corbyn as a leader was strongly rejected, and interestingly, strongly rejected by millions of Labour households, people who have traditionally always voted for him and his party. What I would also say, however, is that economically, listening to the debate, whilst clearly the sort of extreme end of his arguments have failed and been rejected, nevertheless, I think the balance of arguments about big companies not listening to their customers, about a laissez-faire economics, have not won the day. And in a sense, that's why Boris Johnson has listened and is talking about one nation conservatism and having a fairer distribution of the benefits, as it were, of a modern economy. So, yes, a clear rejection of the neo-Marxist arguments that might have come from Corbyn and his colleagues. But actually, I think underlying that, a sense that security for people in terms of economic security, jobs, a roof over their head, is as important as having a vibrant entrepreneurial economy as a whole. And I think that will play into how this parliament works through.
Now, despite the get Brexit done slogan, I don't think anyone would expect the hard work on that front to be done. Nonetheless, what conversations would you hope the country can start having about other issues apart from leaving the EU with this government in place?
I think what's interesting here is, so you're right, I mean, Brexit, obviously, 31st of January, the first phase of withdrawing can be completed by then. And then we get into the debate, which the media obviously have jumped onto immediately, which is, well, what happens next? And I think, first things first, it's clear the government doesn't want to have to extend beyond Christmas of next year, and therefore wants to make that message very clear to their opposite numbers in negotiations. But you're right. I think for the public, it's very much about getting the public services for which they pay, and that is about crime on the streets. It's about a roof over their head. It's about a health service that is working for them locally. I think it's also about some of those big topics, so social care, which plays into the NHS challenge of making sure that our hospitals can deal with more acute issues and isn't finding that actually it's the repository for all those older folk who would otherwise be in the care system. So I think there's a big challenge there. A lot of work's been done in the past. No one's been willing to grasp the nettle. I suspect that the budget, which will come now in February, will actually be the focal point for setting out a pathway forward. So I think that will be an important issue, which for overall, looking at the sort of the big picture, will be something that I think the new MPs will want to get into. And remember, there's 109 of them, so the character of debate at Westminster, I think, will change. I hope it'll be more positive, more open-minded than the sort of Groundhog Day endless debates about... Well, they weren't even debates. They were really just people reasserting their own view over and over again. So I hope that line's been drawn.
Well, we've spoken about this bitterness that you said you saw in Westminster, the divisiveness... Are you hopeful that a new influx of MPs can now change that, that we move on from that atmosphere in our politics?
I think so. The Liberal Democrats have obviously got to think where they are and where they go. Obviously, Labour are already in a fairly bitter fight for their direction, as well as whoever the leader will be. That does allow the government a window of opportunity. I hope it uses it. I always remember when Blair swept with a huge, much larger landslide of, what was it, 197 or something, back in 1997. And I think talking to Labour MPs years after, many of them said we muffed the chance to actually use those first few years to do the tough stuff, the difficult, painful stuff, which, you know, only shows fruition, as it were, 4 or 5 years later. And I think that was one of their great regrets. So I think this next 18 months should be the period when some of the difficult things that need to be done, restructuring Whitehall, devolving power to communities, making sure that the delivery of services is as important as just talking about funding numbers, sort of nitty-gritty stuff that actually makes a difference to people's lives.
What do you see as the biggest challenge ahead for Boris Johnson?
I think... if we can say, for the moment, putting Brexit to one side, indeed, and isn't that a nice thing to say at last, putting Brexit to one side, I think it will be, how do you make sure that the people who have now lent him their votes, whether it's in Redcar or Scunthorpe or wherever, actually see something in return? So that's a big challenge. That means within his party, he's got to make sure that the priority shifts away from perhaps the rural shires towards some of those industrial towns that have been feel they've been left behind. That will shape urban regeneration policy. So that means that, yes, high streets are going to come back into play as a policy issue, very important. But I think it'll also mean looking at the way in which skills, training, economic development, transport work. And so the agenda on devolution, which will be about giving some of those transport planning and economic powers back to localities, and the agenda on actually helping those economies grow, can come together if the way in which the decisions are made is clear. There is a risk that if you get too caught up in what I call the furniture of devolution, you know, who sits where, how many layers are there, and all of that sort of thing, you can lose 2 years or more if you're not careful, because when you restructure a department or any organisation, people start focusing on whether they have a job and where it is, and they start looking inward and they forget that actually they're there to deliver public services. So I think what they've got to be careful about is to say to themselves as a government, right, we've got 4 years maximum. It may be five, but we don't want to presume that. What we've got to do now is to put in place in the next 18 months those things that people will then see in 3 or 4 years' time as making a difference to their lives. And that's, you know, so although it feels like an easy way forward for them, the clock is ticking.
You mentioned the high street as a policy issue. What would you like to see prioritised there?
I think we need to overcome the issue of fragmentation of ownership, because one of the problems in any town centre is there's no one really in charge. And that's about the powers that local authorities have. It doesn't mean repossessing or taking control. What it can mean is providing real leadership. I think The second thing I would say is the various pots of money, and there are some quite considerable ones now, need to be looked at together, and they need to be provided to the communities so they can use them in the way that works for them. There is a habit in Whitehall of saying, right, we want to help, let us say, high streets. So we will, at the centre, devise a policy, and then we will set the criteria, and then we will set the thresholds. And you end up with people trying to tick the box that works for the Whitehall scheme and that doesn't solve the local problem. So you've got to look at the way in which you do that. And you can do that in a number of ways by making it unring-fenced. You can do it by actually, if the local team can deliver match funding, that they will then get an automatic chunk of money without having to demonstrate that it ticks 1,000 boxes. I think also, again, it comes back to devolution. What we need to do is to move away from the silo culture of Whitehall, in which there's a department for transport, which is separate from the department for planning, which is separate from the business department, and allow in a local area, probably through local enterprise partnerships and urban authorities and mayors, the ability to pull that together locally, a single pot, to be able to deliver the thing that matters most in that locality. So that requires restructuring Whitehall. I think it requires reducing Whitehall. I think it also means we're going to see more mayors. And some of those towns are, I think, going to want to see their high streets change quite dramatically. And that's a tough one.
How radical would you like to see Johnson be in terms of revamping, restructuring Whitehall?
I'd like him to crack on with it. I'd like to see the presumption that there will be a single layer of local government in any locality. How they do it locally is up to them. They come forward with recommendations. For example, when I established local enterprise partnerships as the business minister, the habit in the past was that ministers would consult on a policy and then, and I'm putting this slightly cynically, would then do what they were going to do in the first place. That was certainly the view of local government. And so there was startled amazement when Greg Clark and I sat with the various localities and said to them, fine, what is your new economic geography? Tell us what you want it to be, and we will then create the LEP for that geography. And some areas got it. It's not surprising, actually, that the Tees, now having gone quite blue politically, were thrilled, actually, not to be part anymore of one, which everyone told me from the outside of the Northeast wasn't the case, but actually they were excited. And yet in shire areas in the south, the Hertfordshires and so on, which is my own area, they kind of assumed that actually what ministers were saying was, you tell us the geography, but here's a map anyway. And when they realised that actually they could determine it and they could lead it, you know, I think it completely galvanised their whole approach, because they suddenly realised that they were in charge. And some areas took it well and some areas did not. But what was important was we weren't trying to set the how to do it. We were trying to say, here's the opportunity. How do you want to use it? Fine. If that's your approach, we'll back you. And I think that mindset amongst ministers has to be there. It's about freeing those localities to deliver. And they need powers, they need fewer layers, and they need funding.
What might some of those changes look like on the ground? If you were to spin forward the initiatives that you've overseen, what might next steps look like?
Local enterprise partnerships that have more powers in terms of compulsory purchase, in terms of planning, in terms of economic development, many of them led by a mayor, whether they're in a city or not, or you can call it a leader, the title is irrelevant, but the concept of the mayor, the single person accountable to the electorate who is able to look strategically at that travel to work area. That's the kind of thing that we want to see. And, you know, he's an old friend of mine, but Andy Street is exactly the kind of person we want. Someone who's succeeded outside of politics in running a first-class business, maybe doesn't have to be business, but someone who's succeeded in life, who comes into the role of wanting to change their area and has the powers and the funding and the drive to do it. That, I think, would be very exciting.
What else would you expect the business community and the real estate industry to see from this new government?
I think what is important is, first of all, certainty. So the first most important thing, and we're beginning to see this now in the share prices and the value of the currency and so on, is a realization that within certain limits, there's a continuity now and a set of decision making which allows people to make 2, 3, 4, 5 year investment decisions. So that's number one. I think the second thing will revolve around taxes, that they now can be reasonably certain about the tax framework they're going to operate in, particularly around corporation taxes and so on. I think one other thing I would say to businesses, don't assume this is therefore going to be a laissez-faire, old-fashioned conservative government. I think what Johnson understands, what Dominic Cummings understands, is there is a role for government to make sure that actually the benefits of a good economy are fairly distributed. And that isn't, you know, that tinges on the edge of sounding like, you know, wanting to direct things in terms of outcomes. What it's about is recognizing that capitalism in the modern global age doesn't actually work for everybody. And that we have to respect the fact that people need much better support in terms of skills and training, that more people should have a share in the business they work in. And we need to find a way not to direct that, but to enable that. So I think that would be very important. I think also being able to say to those people living in towns which have really struggled, that they can see that their connectivity is good. That means basic things like sensible, reliable bus services and, yes, train services. It means that the training we get from our further education sector is as well funded and supported as the higher education sector. So those sorts of areas, which I think will be important. I think there will also be a pressure on the big corporates who perhaps have not got a good record in consumer services or their delivery from a consumer point of view, that they will need to up their game. I mean, let's be honest, many of our utilities companies have a woeful record with their customers. They need to realize that that is not acceptable, and the government needs to find a way to nudge that behavior so that we get a better service from core utilities. So that's what I meant about, I think, the election and the debate generally recognizing that there is a deep dissatisfaction with remote, faceless corporations. Some of it's well-founded, some of it's not, but a lot of it does need to be responded to, and so that may apply as much to one of the utilities as indeed it would to Facebook.
You touched on transport. Are you encouraged by talk of a boost to infrastructure investment?
Yes. My only worry is that, and I can almost hear the words hurtling towards us now, the phrase shovel-ready, which is much loved of politicians and media, is one that actually is a bit meaningless. I think I'm slightly cautious about grand projet, you know, the huge bridge scheme or whatever, partly because they're always much more expensive than when they're first conceived of, and also they take a hell of a time to deliver benefits. Doesn't mean you shouldn't do them, but you need to be realistic about what they're going to do. So High Speed 2 is a classic example. That, for me, has always been about improving the capacity of the railway network rather than speed. But it was sold on the wrong basis. And also, I think people were sucked into the notion that somehow the whole thing had to be built from London upwards. I would like them, when following this review, for example, to say, actually, what we're going to do is we're not going to pay for any stations, because the landowners, who are going to benefit enormously from this railway line, can jolly well pay for those. We will take a peppercorn rent, and here is the specification. But equally, we're going to start building from the north downwards so they meet in the middle. Mm. I think there are certain things you can do that would actually make people feel, actually, these guys are serious.
What's your gut feeling on HS2 and whether it will get the go-ahead?
At the moment, my gut instinct is they'll do it, but I think Euston will be a big question mark as to whether they do that as an integral part of it, because it's a hell of a cost as a proportion of the overall scheme. I personally am sceptical about whether Euston should have been done as part of that. Simply to get to from where the route is near Old Oak Common across to Euston is a hell of a lot of expense for what is a couple of miles. So there's a case for revamping Euston, absolutely.
Yes, yeah.
But basing High Speed 2 as, you know, linking it together, I think, is wrong. And I think if they can do that, they can make a big difference to the costs. I also personally think, and I remember arguing this when I was in government, that when we're building HS2, at the time we're doing it, we should jolly well be sticking in a big fat water pipe coming down from the Midlands and Wales, to come into the southeast, and we should be putting in a big fat set of data cables as well, because you only get to dig that once. So there's a bit of joined up thinking that could be done there, and then again, you see, you could rent that cable out to the market, and that would be a revenue generator. So there are little things that you could do that actually would help make the scheme much more viable.
Hopeful those might be considered.
Yes, I mean, I think, you know, Grant Shapps is a very commercially minded soul, and comes to it fresh in transport. I think also Number 10 will drive a lot of this. Mm. I think, you know, this will be perhaps what we haven't seen for a while yet, is a much stronger centre, and I expect departments to be restructured, and therefore I think you'll start seeing that the power will rest at Number 10 in a way that perhaps we haven't seen for a few years.
What do you think the new government means for housing?
I think there's a number of things. I think number one, making home ownership more affordable is absolutely front and centre. I think that's a social cause for many Conservatives. And Robert Jenrick, the Secretary of State, has been clear, that the Prime Minister has been clear about that. So I think shared ownership will be simplified and widened out. I think that's generally a good thing. I'm slightly wary of this longer mortgage, you know, fixed rate notion, because we've been around that particular argument several times. Let's see what they come up with. But so home ownership will become right back front and centre. I think the second thing then will be that urban regeneration in our towns will become a really critical issue. It's important socially, it's important economically, it links into high streets. So I think there's going to be quite a lot of policy thinking around how that works and what that means. I think the other thing that will come up will be the fact that there's a strong feeling that quality is as important as quantity. So the work of the, and I got to get this right, Building a Better Britain Commission, the BBBC, their report comes out quite soon, and I think that's going to carry a lot of weight. So the notion of, should we say, standard architectural solutions being applied in every locality will move away, and the argument of having design guides in localities, the use of the local vernacular, there's going to be quite a debate around that. The notion that streets are communities, and that too often we've built housing in a way that's anonymous and that is sterile as a community, and we've got to change that. So I think that will be quite an interesting part of the debate. I think there'll be still reforms on leasehold and so on, but I think the big debate will be around, we need to build more homes that are genuinely affordable, but we also need to have one eye on the quality and whether people feel this is something that it's a place they want to live in.
Mm. As we head towards the end of the year, what would your big hope for 2020 B?
That politics can quietly get on and deliver the things it's promised. I came from the private sector before going into politics, and, you know, I kind of wanted to go in because you can get stuff done and it's important in that context. I think the frustration the last 2 or 3 years has been we've been driving ourselves down a cul-de-sac and discovered that actually just saying no to what you don't want doesn't solve problems. So I would hope in 2020 we have a debate in which the answer is rather like Bob the Builder, yes we can, rather than no, no, no.
Good to hear. Well, Mark, as always, thank you for making time to be here with us today. We'll look forward to chatting with you again, I'm sure, in 2020. But for now, thank you very much, and thank you for listening.
Thank you, and a merry, merry Christmas.